Okay, so today we'll finish this discussion briefly about the localized source in a waveguide or a localized aperture, how that affects, produces new fields. And if you recall, those new fields are described by expansion coefficients into the eigenmodes, TM and TE eigenmodes. And if you can give the expansion coefficients, you know then the solutions generated as a wave goes through, strikes these, either strikes the aperture or the waves coming out of the source. All you need is these. And they're given by the electric dipole moment of the source, magnetic dipole, and the quadrupole moment of the source control most of those coefficients that you need. Of course, you need to know the eigenmodes, but then once you have those, you can use these formulas. For the case of an aperture, of course, it won't generate any solution, any new waves, unless you are sending a wave down the waveguide. And then when that wave encounters the aperture, it will basically send out waves in both directions. And there is an effective dipole moment also for this situation, both electric and magnetic. And I just have to give those formulas. They're in the text also. Epsilon, the electric dipole moment is n hat integral x dot e tangential in the aperture, integrated over the area of the aperture, like in the wall of the waveguide. And the magnetic effective dipole moment is 2 over I mu omega n hat cross E tangential dA. And this E tangential, that's in principle the exact field, electric field in the aperture, tangential E field in the aperture, which usually you don't know, but you would usually approximate that by the incident wave electric field. But I thought that was kind of cool, actually, that, you know, a waveguide with a hole in the aperture. A hole in the wall. Basically, just you can view it as having a dipole moments, electric and magnetic, and then take it from there. Other announcements, the next homework set is posted and due in 2 weeks. There's this discussion about spherical wave, vector wave solutions gets a little intense. It's one of my favorite topics, vector spherical harmonics. And the development, well, I'll start with the radial solution, which is pretty standard and I think is not different from Jackson, but everything about the vector spherical harmonics I handle differently than Jackson. So I suggest you look at one of the references I put in the notes. There's Varshalovich, this famous tome, Quantum Theory of Angular Momentum. I have it on my computer also. You can find it on the web or in the library. And I put also in the supplement directory a sheet of the most important formulas you'll need from the way I handle vector waves, which is different than Jackson's. But I think you'll, if some of you are interested in quantum mechanics, you'll like my treatment because it carries right over into quantum mechanics. It's part of the quantum toolkit. Was there anything else? Don't think so. Okay, so let's go right into section 9.6. Of Jackson's textbook on classical electrodynamics. I think he might have one on particle physics, but I'm not 100% sure. I guess I'll do this too. So basically what we're going to do here is develop machinery to handle vector spherical waves in general, and develop a systematic way to treat spherical geometries like a spherical cavity that has electromagnetic waves, photons bouncing around inside a spherical cavity, for instance, or for non-spherical sources. We'll often want to use spherical coordinates and develop multiple expansion. So let me start with an analogy from what we did last semester. So if you remember, we had electrostatics, partial differential equations we were trying to solve. Inhomogeneous PDEs. For instance, one you came to know and love, del squared phi is minus rho over epsilon naught. This could be solved if there are no boundaries just by integrating over all the charges in the universe. Phi of x was an integral of 1 over 4 pi epsilon naught. The charge is at a source point x prime over the distance from the observation point to the source point d cubed x prime. And more generally, if there were boundaries, it was useful to introduce a Green's function expansion. For instance, the spherical Green's function approach, for the case with no boundaries, was for a Green's function, we are now going to have it obey del squared g of x, x prime is minus delta of x minus x prime, and we will not keep the 4 pi that we had in electrostatics, was convenient in electrostatics. So that means our Green's function now has an extra 4 pi factor in the denominator. If you remember, it was just 1 over r in electrostatics, now it's 1 over 4 pi r, where r is this distance between x and x prime. And our Green's function spherical expansion in this case for the Laplace equation was this formula, very useful formula, 1 over 2l plus 1, r lesser to the l over r greater to the l plus 1, ylm star of x hat prime, meaning theta prime, phi prime, and YLM of x hat, meaning theta phi of the observation point. And r lesser, again, is the smaller of r and r prime, r greater is the larger of r and r prime. Okay, but we're interested in wave equations. So we have now these equations, del squared phi, for instance, when we're interested in the potential, minus 1 over c squared d squared phi dt squared is going to equal minus rho over epsilon naught. This is one of the PDEs we want to solve, which we will rewrite for monochromatic waves, frequency omega and wave number k, as del squared plus k squared phi of x is equal to minus rho over epsilon naught. Again, that's for monochromatic or harmonic waves, which is what we'll focus on, really, this whole chapter. And we can tackle this also by finding a Green's function for this operator on the right-hand side. Del squared plus k squared g of x, x prime is minus delta x minus x prime. And we found in chapter 6 already that Green's function in closed form. So for free space, no boundaries, we have the Helmholtz equation Green's function. If you remember some of that discussion, it's not unique, actually. If you just say you want the free space Green's function, it's not unique. But if you say you want outgoing waves, right, that you have a source, this direct delta function source, producing waves, and you want a source happen, jiggling charges or currents, and waves go away from it causally to later times, this is the relevant Green's function that produces outgoing waves. Sometimes it's written with a G plus to stress that fact. And some wacky funsters like Richard Feynman and his thesis advisor John Wheeler have other weird scenarios where you have waves going backward in time, which is pretty interesting too. And again, R, when I write it as a full vector, it's the vector to observation point minus the source point. So just like we found this useful for treating spherical problems in electrostatics, this sum of separable terms, this is helpful because often it's hard to do the integrals if you don't have separability of R and R prime. And so we want a similar separability for the Helmholtz equation, and that is this equation. I'll write out more explicitly as an identity. I'll first write the identity and then I'll derive it. Okay, this you need to either memorize this formula I'm about to write or know where to find it whenever you need it. And you can find it in Jackson in various places. It's a sum over all partial waves. The spherical Bessel function JL of KR, that's the one regular at the origin, for R lesser, times the outgoing spherical wave, spherical Bessel function Hankel version of order 1, or of type 1, which is the outgoing type of the Hankel spherical Bessel functions. There's an HL of 2, which is incoing, which we usually won't care about. The HL1 is outgoing and looks at infinity like e to the IKR over R and some other stuff of KR greater. And then it's times the sum over M, right, from minus L to L of YLM star of X hat prime YLM of X hat. That's a key formula we will use a bunch. So let me run through a quick derivation of this, an application basically of method 2 we had last semester for finding Green's functions, where you expand, if you remember, in a complete basis set in all coordinates except one coordinate in the system. And then you treat the extra coordinate using the Wronskian method. So, start with a completeness expansion in the angles. Meaning, the way we do that normally, we write our unknown Green's function as a sum of a one-dimensional Green's function in the remaining coordinate we're going to treat separately, still unknown. And now we've built this with the completeness sum of spherical harmonics. And once we find this GL of RR prime, we will be done. But before I just dive into that math, let me remind you a few of the standard properties that we'll need to invoke, useful to invoke about the spherical harmonics, and operators we're going to also be encountering when we get on to vector spherical harmonics. One thing is a standard way to write del squared in spherical coordinates, one of my favorite ways, is 1 over r squared d by dr, r squared d by dr, minus the squared angular momentum operator, l squared of theta and phi over r squared. This L operator is basically the same one you learn about in quantum mechanics, position crossed into momentum, except we don't have an H bar here, so I'll divide the H bar out of the momentum operator. So that means this is actually the position representation of the momentum operator without the H bar, which is just minus I del. That's what we'll call the angular momentum operator. Just in analogy with quantum mechanics, just without the H-bar. And the nice thing about this is that YLMs are eigenfunctions, simultaneous eigenfunctions of the L-squared operator and the LZ operator, just like you learn in your quantum course. So in particular, if you make use of these eigenfunction properties in a derivation like this, it simplifies your life because then you don't have to take all these complicated angular derivatives and stuff. You can just directly use the fact that these are eigenfunctions. All right, so LZ, YLM, theta phi, of course, is M, YLM, theta phi, and L squared YLM is LL plus 1 YLM. And so coming back to our Green's function equation that we want to solve, sum over L and M of del squared, 1 over R squared d by dr, R squared d by dr, minus L squared over R squared plus K squared now, because we have the Helmholtz equation instead of the Laplace equation. And now our radial Green's function and our angle stuff, YLM star of x hat prime, YLM of x hat. This all has to equal minus delta of R minus R prime over R squared or R prime squared. You can write that either way, since the delta function will only be non-zero at R equals R prime. And then the angular, two-dimensional angular delta function. And basically this angular delta function, we have basically built that into the structure, the assumed form of our sum, because this by itself would be sum over L and M of just YLM star of X hat prime YLM of X hat. That alone gives the delta function in angles. So how are you going to get rid of that? Well, one way would be to multiply by YLM star of X hat and integrate. But I like to just kind of do this step by inspection. Namely, one way you could solve this equation is if this quantity in square brackets, this part of it, if that turned out to be independent of L and M, as it must be in order for that to equal delta of R minus R prime. There's no L and M here, right? So for I should include the sum in that. No, I guess I shouldn't. Anyway, if this thing I circled is equal to this delta of R minus R prime for every L, then I will have solved the equation. So I can write that now as a separate equation I have to solve. Is this circled thing equal to the minus delta of R minus R prime over R squared? Maybe I won't write it because it's right in front of us already. This equals that. Okay, so let me remind you about our favorite identity from Sturm-Liouville land, the Sturm-Liouville Green's function. We derived last semester the Sturm-Liouville operator. I think maybe we called it LX hat for a generic coordinate X. When it acts on something like G, this is defined to be d by dx of one function p of x d by dx, g of x, x prime, plus another function times the undifferentiated solution we want, g of x, x prime. And for the Sturm-Liouville Green's function, we want to solve that this will equal delta of x minus x prime over there could be some extra x prime dependent function here on the right hand side. And this is over some interval, like a less than or equal to x, less than or equal to b. And of course, the same range for x prime for this independent coordinate x and x prime. And the way we tackled that and found the Green's function was, right, it's a second order differential operator, so there will be two independent solutions. And we assume that the two independent solutions, one of them obeys the boundary condition at x equals a, and the other obeys whatever is the relevant boundary condition at x equals b. So basically u1 of x will obey this with zero, the homogeneous equation with zero on the right-hand side. At x equals a boundary condition, might be the Neumann, might be Dirichlet, and so on. And u2 of x is whatever is the solution obeying the differential homogeneous equation and the boundary condition at x equals b. These will normally be different because they obey boundary conditions at different points. There could be exceptional situations where a solution obeys both boundary conditions, but for now I'm going to ignore that possibility. So once we have all that, we've found those two independent solutions, we can just write down the one-dimensional Green's function in one line. And you can review the notes from last semester if that derivation is a little rusty. But the result was, and I use this all the time, so it's a useful formula, minus u1 of x lesser, u2 of x greater, divided by beta of x prime, and p of x prime times the Wronskian of u1 and u2 at x prime. So for our present problem with no boundaries, we have a domain of R from 0 to infinity. So we can map the problem, the radial problem we are solving, onto this form. Basically, I would need to make it look exactly like this, I'd need to multiply through this equation by R squared, both sides of the equation. And then we can just read off P of R in the Sturm-Liouville equation would be R squared beta of R prime after multiplying by R squared will be just 1. And there are some standard homogeneous solutions for this operator that are very well known. UL of R for a given L, one of them is JL of KR, that's the one, again, spherical Bessel function, regular at R equals 0. All the others are irregular at R equals 0, including the Neumann function, also sometimes written YL of KR. And then there are the Hankel functions, either type 1 outgoing, type 2 incoming of KR. We have to pick two solutions of these and or linear combinations of them to match boundary conditions. Right, any linear combination with constant coefficients would also obey that homogeneous equation. So I will pick, because I had no boundaries, I'll pick U1 of R that's going to go into this formula to be JL of KR. I want outgoing waves, so I'll pick U2 of R, and I have no boundary except at infinity, so U2 of R will pick to be the outgoing wave Hankel function. And now this P of R prime, Wronskian of JL and HL, this is a constant. It better turn out to be independent of R prime. And because it's been proved formally that it will be independent of R prime, thanks to properties of the Sturm-Liouville operator, we can use that and just pick a convenient R prime where we calculate that Wronskian. And usually what that means is it's going to be simplest to calculate the Wronskian if you go to the small r limit or the large r limit. So I will do this at the small r limit, where, and just use the leading terms, where the Hankel function, outgoing wave Hankel function of KR, has the following form near R going to zero. It's minus I times 2L minus 1 double factorial over KR to the L plus 1. You can look this up or type it into the web. It's easy to find this kind of information. Mathematica, if you use the series command, you could also get it that way. And JL of KR in that limit of small r, the leading order term is KR to the L over 2L plus 1 double factorial. And I'll spare you the algebra and just give you the Wronskian P of R W of U1 and U2. I'll skip a line that's in the notes. Simplifies to just minus I over K. So finally, my radial Green's function for the Lth partial wave has to be IK JL of KR lesser, HL1 of KR greater. And if we plug that in, we'll have our Green's function. I'll write it again because it is important. IK sum over all L and M, JL of KR lesser, HL1 of KR greater, YLM star, X hat prime, YLM of X hat. And this formula, which we'll be using for a fair amount, will be important. Those of you who are learning quantum scattering theory, this kind of formula is used all the time in those derivations also. Okay, I think we're ready to tackle the vector nature of the problem, the beast, which is section 9.7. Which we'll phrase this way. We're going to work out a systematic way to do a multiple expansion of electromagnetic fields in spherical geometry. So let's start with Maxwell's equations in a region with no sources. and harmonic fields. All right, so we've got del dot E is 0, del dot H is 0. We also have del cross E is IK times the impedance of free space, Z naught, H, and del cross H is minus IK over Z naught E. And now these equations can be solved in a couple of different ways. And they connect with our ideas about TM and TE modes that we discussed at some length in Chapter 8. So that may seem surprising because there's no waveguide here. I see you all shocked by this comment, and rightly so. The idea of TM and TE modes is still actually useful here. But those will be TM or TE in terms of the components of the fields along the radial vector. That's going to play the role of the propagation direction that we had in the waveguide. Okay, so there are basically two types of waves we're going to be calculating. There will be, I guess I'm calling it in the notes, case A, which are the TM modes, which some people also call electric multipoles. This always annoyed me, because when I think TM, I don't think electric, I think magnetic. But anyway, the TM modes, for some reason, are called electric multipoles. The strategy, when you want to calculate the TM spherical modes, is the idea, the logic, is to first solve the wave equation for the vector field H, okay, which is really three solutions of our Helmholtz equation, three components. After you find H, then calculate E by taking the curl of it. Okay, so that leads to this sequence of equations. Step one, solve del squared plus k squared h is 0. Step two, enforce that it has 0 divergence. Third, get the E field by taking the curl. E is I z naught over k, curl of H. And that will give you the TM modes. And those will have a component of electric field along R that's non-zero, but not for H. Case B are the TE modes, also called the magnetic multipoles. Where it's the reverse order, we'll first solve the wave equation, Helmholtz equation for E, and then calculate H by taking the curl. So again, step one, find solutions for the three components of the E field that obey that, the general solution. Then it will be restricted by enforcing that del dot E is zero, which effectively enforces transversality and it'll mean there will be no radial component of E. And then third step will be calculate H as minus I over KZ naught curl of E. All right, so that's basically what we're going to do, except plus on top of that, we're going to do a multipole expansion also. Assuming that we have like sources where the charges and currents are maybe jiggling, is localized. Okay, so first of all, let's write the general solution of the Helmholtz equation, the vector Helmholtz equation, in terms of a set of constants. So I'll call the constants kind of like we did for our modes that we wrote as a sum over all the eigenmodes of a waveguide. Now it's sort of like the mode solutions will have spherical harmonics, actually vector spherical harmonics in a bit, and spherical Bessel functions. So I'm going to write it, the constants we're going to need to find later. I'll call ALM of 1, 2. And these characterize our vector solution H that I'll write as sum over LM of these vector of constants ALM of 1. Times the outgoing wave Hankel function of argument kr plus ALM of 2 times vector constant times I'll use now for my second independent solution I'll use HL of 2 of kr. And then all that multiplies, of course, a YLM of X hat. I think you can see each term, its spatial dependence will obey the Helmholtz equation in spherical coordinates. Okay, but now if we're going to do the TM case, we need to enforce del dot H is zero. Okay, we've already solved step one. We have a general solution for step one, but del dot H has to be imposed to be zero. Now, how to do it? That is the key question here. One way is to begin an endless sequence of nasty identities. Like, start with maybe this identity, R over R, way to write del, D by dr, minus I over R squared, R cross L. That's one way to write the gradient operator in terms of our orbital angle momentum operator stripped of its H bar. Then take that form, apply it to terms like sum over L and M, HL of KR of either type, times YLM, ALM, apply it to that, demand that this go to zero, the whole expression, and basically this is Jackson's approach. But I like to develop a more general tool. So here I deviate from Jackson. And what we will do is instead, we will develop the theory of vector spherical harmonics. And I'll show you how this connects to quantum mechanics problems and also methods like Clebsch-Gordan coefficients that are very standard in the quantum world. I gave three references. You can easily find all three of these. They're wrote in page 84 of the notes. There's Varsilovich. There's a book by Edmonds called Angular Momentum and Quantum Mechanics. And there's a famous theoretical nuclear physics book by Blatt and Weisskopf that has an appendix on this topic. All those are good references. Okay, but as I like to do, I'm not just going to present a bunch of formulas. I'm going to kind of show you where the concepts came from, which start by going back and understanding in detail how do you take a vector field and rotate it? Let's start with that simple question. How would you do it? Rotate what? Well, the thing is we'll see, we're not going to grab the coordinate axes. We are going to actually grab the vector field and rotate the vector field. That's the active sense of rotation, yeah. As opposed to the passive, which would be if we grab the coordinate axes and rotate them in the opposite direction, which you could set this all up that way, but usually in the quantum world, we use the active sense. Yeah, there will be matrices. Oh, you want to rotate a tensor, not just the vector fields? Is that why you're talking about a matrix? Okay, well, anyway, I think you'll find this useful if you haven't thought about rotation in a while. At least for me, this was a tricky concept to really wrap my head around. And so I hope what I've learned will help make it easier for you to see it all the way through. And why this connects to the quantum mechanics of a spin one particle is one of the keys here. Okay, so let's start with a classical vector field A of X. And we're going to assume that its governing equations, which in this case are things like the Helmholtz equation, but could have other equations, we'll assume they are invariant under coordinate rotations. And I'll also assume reflections, or the parity operator, in quantum language. What that means more concretely is that if you have one solution, A of x, then another is one I will call A prime of x. Which you obtain by grabbing A of x, the whole damn thing, everywhere, with the big hands, grab A of x and rotating it through an angle. And I'll pick an angle about the z-axis for now. Let's say I rotate it by an angle alpha about z. And when you do that, okay, you grab, right, you have vector field, so at every point in space, it's got a direction and a magnitude. When you grab it and rotate it, everything is rotated. The position is rotated. The vector angle is rotated. We have to keep track of both of those aspects. Does that make sense? A quizzical puppy dog look. And the math will handle both aspects. So let me write, before I kind of explain where these formulas come from, let me write what the actual formulas look like. For this rotation about the z-axis of the full vector field by some angle alpha, I claim that there will be a new x component of the vector of the rotated field x prime. And remember, this is a field which has a dependence on x, y, and z. And this rotation ends up mixing the old x and y components with cosine and sine. So you get cosine alpha times the old ax, but evaluated at a new position. That new position has an x coordinate changed to x cos alpha plus y sine alpha. It has a y component changed to y cos alpha minus x sine alpha, and z is unchanged. And this gets added to, or subtracted, minus sine alpha ay of x cos alpha plus y sine alpha, the same point in space, y cos alpha minus x sine alpha z. So that's the new x component at a position x, y, z. will be the old, a mixture of the old X and Y components of the original field evaluated at a different point in space. And I'll explain, give you some intuition where that came from later. Similarly, a Y prime at X, Y, and Z works out to be sine alpha AX evaluated at X cos alpha plus Y sine alpha Y cos alpha minus X sine alpha Z plus cos alpha AY of the same point in space. And finally, a z prime, since we rotated about the z axis, a z prime of xyz is equal only to az, the old az, but at a different point in space, namely the same point in space we talked about for all of these components. Namely, x cos alpha plus y sine alpha, y comma y cos alpha minus x sine alpha, and z. Okay, now one kind of odd thing that you might notice about these formulas is that the components appear to be rotated in the opposite sense compared to the vector inside the vector field. And that I want to explain, kind of give you some intuition about why that is so. So the components are rotated by alpha, but the vector argument of the field is rotated by minus alpha. So I want to give you a reason why by looking at a very simple two-dimensional world for a moment. Okay, so let's consider a two-dimensional vector field. And when I encounter a problem like this, I usually like to have a concrete example so we can actually see how things rotate for a specific field. So I'll take a concrete case of a field I'm just inventing that I wrote in the notes, a vector field that depends only on the phi angle everywhere in space, and define it to be phi hat sine of phi, which I want to write its Cartesian components, the phi hat unit vector. If you don't remember it, you can look it up or rederive it. Is minus x hat sine phi plus y hat cos phi, and then that multiplies sine phi. So when we talk about rotations, first thing you usually want to do is characterize the rotation by just what happens to a vector first. Okay. So first, let's just rotate a vector. A vector r, we'll rotate it into a new vector r prime by alpha about the z-axis. Okay, so we have our xy coordinates. We have, let's pick a vector r here. Pick a smallish angle alpha, which would be easy to visualize. We're going to rotate it into r prime. We grabbed it and rotated in the positive sense of a rotation about the z-axis. And it's easy to work out the components of r prime just by simple trig. The x component of r prime will be x cos alpha minus y sine alpha, and from the original vector r, and the y component will be x sine alpha plus y cos alpha. Now, if you don't remember those, you can kind of check that they make sense. You know that there are going to be just cosines and sines involved in that formula. What you may not remember is which signs are positive, which ones are negative, and where do the cosine and sine go. And of course, the x component makes sense. If we're talking about a small rotation, the cosine is going to go with the new x component, and the cosine is going to go times y in the new y component. But now, does it make sense that this has a negative y for its x component? Well, you can see this has a smaller x component than r. R prime has a smaller x component, so it makes sense that that's a minus sign, and it has a larger y component than r, so you know that it had to be plus sine alpha. So that's an easy way to remember these, where the pluses and minuses and the sines go, sines and cosines go. So this can be viewed as a rotation matrix. X prime, y prime is a matrix cos alpha minus sine alpha cos alpha times xy of the original vector. And we'll call this our rotation matrix R for this rotation in the positive sense through alpha about the z-axis. Just call it R, or maybe even R of alpha when I want to be concrete. So now let's look what happens to this vector field example. Artistic abilities are limited, but let me give it a shot. Let's start by looking at the unrotated vector field. In the xy plane, if we sort of look around a circle somewhere, can draw the vector field, right? There's a sine phi, so at phi equals 0, which is on the x-axis, the fields are very tiny. There's a tiny arrow here if I go just above the x-axis, above, and there's a tiny arrow pointing downward if I go a small amount below the x-axis. If I go to pi over 2, there is no y component, but I have a negative x sine squared, which is now large, at pi over 2. And down here, I also have a minus sine squared phi, so it's also. And similarly, on the negative x-axis, it looks similarly, except just opposite sign. Very small vectors, but pointing in opposite directions, just above and just below. So that's my depiction of the unrotated field, A of phi. And now we'll do an active rotation of this field. through alpha. And so I claim we'll have some new angle alpha here. And so now we expect, if I look at this circle, same circle as before, then here I'm going to have this, I grab this and rotate it up, so I have these small oppositely oriented fields here, and here tangential to that, the big fields going this way, and then here the opposite small components of opposite direction. So that's my rotated A prime of phi. That's what the new rotated vector field looks like. So I think you can see that I claim that now the new vector field A prime of phi is the rotation matrix has rotated these vector components, and but they are evaluated at the negatively rotated coordinate, right? In other words, the field at this angle alpha is equal to the original field at phi minus alpha. And so that basically is why you get this formula that I found counterintuitive the first time I, before I thought through this logic, which says that A prime of x can be written in general as a rotation matrix of the vector at the anti-rotated position. Is the key formula for how a vector field rotates. Does that make sense? Yeah. Now, like we often do in quantum mechanics, it's useful to look at this in the infinitesimal limit. Of course, you could always build up a finite rotation by a sequence of infinitesimal rotations. So in the infinitesimal limit, the math gets pretty simple. So we're going to take alpha to be a tiny, tiny number, an infinitesimal. And then the formulas look as follows: A prime of x will be to first order A of x with a very small correction of order alpha. And we can write, it's useful to write that as an operator, I alpha times an operator, which ends up being the total angular momentum operator in quantum mechanics, Jz, acting on A of x. Let me be a little more concrete. We can write that full rotation operator as 1 minus I alpha times an orbital angular momentum, which is going to handle the spatial part of the rotation of the field, and a spin operator, Sz, which is going to handle the components rotating. And it's going to be the spin matrices analogous to a spin one particle, right, which also has three components in the quantum world. So that's a way to write our infinitesimal rotation operator that connects with our quantum ideas. In this case, Lz in particular is actually just what you expect from the quantum world, minus I d by d phi. And Sz is a 3x3 matrix, rotation matrix, that will specify how the components get changed by this rotation. And let me give you that SZ operator for this simple example of rotating about the Z axis. SZ operating on a three-component Cartesian vector needs to give minus IAY from the math we worked out over there, minus IAX for the new Y component, and unchanged for the new Z component, which I write in matrix notation as this rotation, infinitesimal rotation operator, 0 minus I0, I00, 000, times the vector unrotated. That controls this mixing of components, how the vector of the vector field, how its direction is changing. Okay, so this operator, JZ, is, again, just analogous to combining spin and orbital angular momentum in quantum mechanics. And yeah, I guess I'm kind of out of time. Next time I'll continue from here and work out the eigenstates of S, Z, which are not very hard to find, but this will be useful, I think. Okay, see you Monday.